Mark. Two legs good, track four bad.
Oh, jeez.
Welcome back to Unsung
Podcast.
Still
here. We're still here.
Aye. That's Grant Donaldson. Hello. Grant Donaldson.
He's since joined MI6 after the last episode.
He's actually just started MI7.
Have you seen that?
What?
MI7.
What's that?
Mission Impossible 7.
Oh, right, okay. No, yeah, I have actually. The first part of it, you mean?
Yeah.
It's good.
Pretty good, yeah. I'm bringing the tone down good a little bit, yeah. So
it's great that you were able to make the time for us, you? Probably weren't in part two. Mark, how you doing?
I'm all right.
You host this podcast, don't you?
I'm one of the hosts.
Yeah.
I host it with my very good friend.
Is that me?
Aye.
Yes.
Chris. That's Chris, by the way.
We're near enough halfway through Radio Kerrang Volume 6 as part of this Cover Mount mixtape. We invited the Grant Donaldson in to take part in a very irreverent and unrehearsed episode. I mean, these ones are fun because you don't have to wade through piles and piles and piles of notes.
Just piles and piles and piles of shit.
Yeah, you just, yeah.
It's trickier in a different way, isn't it?
It is. Well, yeah, that's the thing as well, because you do want to do a tiny bit of background, and in this case, you have to do it in 14 different bands. 15, actually. 15 different bands. But anyway, it's easier. You don't have to fucking cite anything. You could just give your opinions, and if it's bullshit, and then just shrug.
Wait a second. You said 15.
Yeah, there's a bonus track called... The video.
I forgot about the video.
Oh, poor you.
But Cold were in the last one anyway.
Yeah,
so
it doesn't matter.
Is it the same song?
It wasn't in the Google Drive folder, so I assume they were any doing it.
Oh, well, it's...
What song is it?
It's an enhanced CD, and it's got the video for Give.
Give. I think that was their big single.
We're just recovering from how much we enjoyed 1 Minute Silence. track 6 on this compilation. Grant,
I really hope he's listening, man.
Grant, who was too young at the time to be disturbed by it, has now had it foisted upon him. So you think you'll go and explore more 1 Minute Silence stuff?
I think I will, just out of curiosity.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that track I mentioned, is it, I think it's 1845, something like that. That's a pretty good track. I wish I could remember who it was I saw them playing with. I think it was at the Barras.
Must have been a pretty big band then if you saw them supporting.
Yeah, no, he saw them with Slipknot.
Slipknot, and you saw them at like Bars or something like that. Yeah, so I mean, it must have been a pretty decent size.
They got a lot of support. Actually, some of the bands we're talking about were like sort of perennial support bands. You know, that you just saw them on loads and loads of tours, even though they never quite got to like the next level themselves.
I think in this era, this is just a reflection generally, is that there are bands that get signed to major labels in this era of music where you can tell they're never, ever, ever going to reach that. There's just something missing, mm-hmm. whether it's like ability or the actual nous to write a good chorus. Because 1 Minute Silence are good at, quote unquote, good at a few things, but they never had a really catchy song like Slipknot did, for example. You know,
they tried a lot of Rage Against Machine, but they never really got their bomb track or Killing in the Name. Yeah. So we're going to continue the theme of rap rock with a band called Bully Rag, a track called Thug's Prayer. This is the only one that's not on Spotify from this entire collection.
They only released one record.
Yeah, it's a bit more interesting though than first glance. You know, the guitarist on this plays on Northern Lad with Tori Amos.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. It's courtesy of Free With This Month's...
There we go. Shout out to Free With This Month's issue.
...podcast. The drummer in Bully Rag, I believe, ended up doing a bunch of session stuff. I think he played for like fucking Will Young and Sugar Babes and stuff like that.
Oh, really? Wow.
And also, I looked up the cover art for Songs of Praise, which is the album this was taken from, their only album. The album art is really familiar. Anyway, when I saw it, I was like, oh, fuck aye. Mm-hmm. It's like a cartoon baby crying with the band's logo and the name inside its mouth. I mean, obviously, this is also rap rock. Okay, so we've just done 1 Minute Silence, but it's like a... It's a different kind of rap rock, mate.
Yeah.
I don't particularly like this. This is not my style of music, but it feels much more authentic, I think, less contrived. I mean, their Facebook, I might add, says punk, metal, reggae, soul, funk, jazz, fusion. Like, they clearly saw themselves as being quite a
cast the net pretty wide with that, haven't they?
Yeah, they did. But actually, you can hear quite a lot of it. There's like fucking trip hop in the chorus for this one, you know?
Definitely reggae in the vocals, you know.
And it reminds me a wee bit of a band called Lodestar, who I think probably were around just a couple of years prior to this. More experimental, like a lot of rap, a lot of metal riffs, but they took a lot more chances with instrumentation. Like there was quite a lot of like dubby stuff and quite a lot of trip hop stuff. Because bear in mind as well, like early to mid 90s, as well as all the grunge and stuff, you had all those bands like Portishead and stuff coming through, and Tricky and Goldie and people like that. Yeah, their Facebook currently lists Robert as the only remaining member.
And the vocalist.
Yeah, it has a really cool old press release on it. Like they've basically sort of started to archive a bunch of relics from their past days. And this old press release, you can kind of zoom in and read it. And the press release says, you know, the band started in 1989. It was Robert Awork and Stuart Boyle. They were the two founding members. But that the band properly started in 1992, where they brought in a guy called Michael Cusick and Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan actually played with Paul McCartney's brother's band. Is it Mike McCartney? He was in a band called The Scaffold.
Okay.
And it also, in this press release, it says that Bullyrag were like flooded by offers from like all the, you know, the usual suspects, like Island Records, all these different A&R people descending on them around about this time when everything really clicked together as a band, but they sort of shied away from the deals. And I think it's really quite interesting to see how a band from that level of buzz went to being like basically the only band that doesn't have their stuff on Spotify. They're sort of like somewhat forgotten by time. I mean, I'm fairly confident somebody at some point will convince them to put that stuff up there, but it's just interesting how much they fell off the radar of music, having been kind of right on the brink of doing something that looked quite sizable.
Yeah, I think this song, I don't know, I can't really say that I liked it, but there's bits of it I definitely liked. Like, so for example, this actually feels like they've got a rapper in the band and not just a guy that's doing new metal rapping, you know, like in 1 minute silence. This guy actually seems as though he knows his craft a little bit, which is good. And that authenticity actually really helps with the delivery of the vocal. It makes it feel more rap and a little bit more interesting than just yap shouting, basically.
Less posturing. Yeah.
Because it's got like some of the heavier parts are like kind of like the same old beige new metal sludge that was all over the place at the time. But there's like some atmospheric sections, I guess, or lucid sections.
There's a good solo in it as well.
Jazzy, that bluesy guitar solo is really, really nice. It feels like it's got a lot more life to it than a lot of other songs in this record, or this collection, which are in the same genre. I think they were obviously flirting with new metal. There's parts of it in it, but I don't think I would ever really put them in that category, you know?
Yeah, they strike as the kind of band that ended up on bills with a lot of bands that they sort of, yeah, okay, I can see why we're on this bill, but I don't really relate to it.
Yeah.
You know? What are your thoughts?
Given the list of tracks I'd been listening to before,
when it's coming off the
when it came off the back of Psycore and 1 minute silence, the intro, I was like, oh, this is interesting. It's like, I don't think it was good, but I was like, oh, this could go somewhere interesting. And then it goes into the new metal bit, and then it ABs that far too many times for the song, and it's a wee bit long, and it feels just a bit baggy and stuff. But yeah, I don't like it, but it is more interesting than like some of the stuff we've had.
Yeah.
I think it never really hits the mark for me.
It's probably one of the most sonically interesting songs on the record. Like, it goes in different directions that other songs in this just don't do.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, there were bands doing this, but they, I think actually their sound became almost sometimes too subtle to break through to the bigger levels, whereas the bands like fucking Mudvayne and bands like that broke through had their tracks were pretty much more consistent.
I think it's maybe because it's the kind of dubby thing, but it puts me in mind of Dub War, who were like a kind of dubby punky band that flirted with new metal, which ended up breaking up in the singer form Skindred.
Strike, Oh right.
Yeah, okay. And Skindred's career has been absolutely fucking wild. I don't know if you know how fucking big they are now, but they are massive.
Yeah, they won an award there too, yeah, last year. Yeah,
I
saw that.
But I seen them support. I went to see El Nino and the Barras.
El Nino.
Yeah, and the headliners were Pods, POD. They were fucking dreadful, right? But Skindred were playing, and Skindred were like one of the most interesting and fun bands in that entire bill. And their career's kind of been up and down, but it's only really...
Why
been,
were you at that show?
To see, I liked El Nino at the time.
So when was this?
2000, and probably the same year I seen 1 Minute Silence, but 2001.
All right, for some reason I thought this was like...
recent.
No, so did that. Definitely not recently.
What have I got into here?
Skindred have kind of rid the wave out of nu metal, and as it's come back around, which it has done over the past 5 years, they've kind of infused it with like bits of post-hardcore and bits of just like mainstream rock, and it's just why they've become so big now, like selling at the Barras and all that.
Interesting.
Which, so like, but they started off sounding a little bit like this, but more on the metal side and a bit more on the reggae side as well. So I can see like some parallels there career wise that maybe this band didn't continue after this record, but I could easily have seen them on that path.
Clearly the members of this band, or some of them at least, have gone on to like have pretty strong session careers, and I think the guy Paul Ryan had been in a bunch of stuff before this as well. And the compilation takes a total fucking right angle turn here into like quintessential Brit rock in the form of Janis Stark and the track Every Little Thing Counts. When I say Brit rock, this is pre kind of 100 Reasons era Brit rock.
Three Colours Red style.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So Three Colours Red, China Drum, Therapy, The Wild Hearts.
Even Feeder and Ash.
Midget, Early Feeder. Ash were a bit more indie, but yeah. So Giz Butt, the main guy in this band, played guitar for Prodigy. Like when Prodigy were at their biggest.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But before that, like he had total pedigree. So he was also a member of the punk legends like English Dogs and the UK Subs. So the guy had been doing a lot of things for a long time. One thing that I believe set Giz Butt apart from other punk guitarists is that he was a fairly amazing technical player, apparently. Like, he could really shred, he could thrash, which gave his bands a bit of an edge. They could go musically to places that other punk bands couldn't, as well as making them more versatile, hence why he probably got the Prodigy gig. I actually saw Janis Stark a couple of times, including one of them at a punk club in Falkirk, I think it was. It was just one of these bands that the promoter managed to snare, and we all turned up to see it. And I mean, they were good. They never fucking blew my mind. Again, free with this week's issue. Fucking love this tune, like absolutely love this tune. I can't say I share their enthusiasm. I think there are some really nice touches. The chorus is hooky as fuck, even though it doesn't really appeal to me. I can see how it is memorable. There's a really clever wee shift in the refrain as well. It's about 3 minute mark. They just do a once off chord change that's just clever. It's a nice wee touch.
Oh yeah, yeah.
This tune actually got some pretty decent sort of 90s teen movie sync as well.
A minor hit it was for them.
Aye, well, it was in Disturbing Behaviour, which is a Katie Holmes vehicle, and it was in Varsity Blues, which funnily enough is a James Vanderbeek vehicle, as well as like a young Paul Walker and stuff like that. So even in the States it started to get a bit of traction. So I mean, it seems like it did alright.
This was released in Earache Records, and there's two Earache bands on this this compilation. This is not something that you would imagine Earache would ever put out. You know, this is just not a kind of Brit rock inflected late 80s.
It could just be that
punk,
they actually,
you know,
knew them, like, personally, though. Because,
probably,
yeah. Because Giz was such a figure on that scene. in his local area especially.
I think it's fine. It's really, really well played, really competent. There are some nice touches to it, like you say. I didn't find the chorus particularly hooky, and that I do, obviously.
Well, it's that thing where I'm like, I can see on paper that it's a hook. It doesn't really speak to me, but I can, I mean, it's well constructed, it's repetitive, it's kind of, I get it. It just doesn't really connect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought the same. The verses and like the guitar solo, and they've got like nice effects. There's like a phaser guitar panning from the left to the right. It going into certain sections. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cool stuff in it, mm-hmm. but the chorus is like one of the least interesting parts.
That's what people remember though. So
I know, yeah. but no, I really like this one actually. I was surprised. Yeah. The more I listen to it, it's kind of starts kind of like REM. Like kind of like that kind of guitar lick coming
actually.
In,
yeah,
really are the M, and then
it's like Bad Day. I think it's the track Bad Day.
And then like quite kind of Cobain-esque vocals. But I think this could have been in the first Foo Fighters album.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because you're talking about the guy's pedigree and how competent and how well played this is. Like, there's still a critical piece missing, which you can be the best player in the world and just never have. No, which is like writing the soaring chorus to make the song like this really.
I think we can say a huge dick.
Yeah, well, and that too. But
we'll be missing all these years.
Yeah. It's like the only fucking thing. Yeah.
That's why we're talking about music and not playing it live.
Yeah. Exactly, man. I think so. Like that is a critical piece. And you think, you know, see if they got into a major record label, somebody would have written that for them, or they would have worked with a producer which would have guided them to write that hit, you know, which they just don't quite get.
I never really heard anything else by them. I didn't get the album, and I don't recall any other really big songs.
I think it did one more record, maybe.
Oh, they probably did, but I just mean there were no other tracks that jumped out, you know. Whereas like bands like Three Colours Red, Wild Hearts, Therapy, they had sort of multiple standout tracks. I don't remember anything else by Janis Stark, but there you go. I mean, fuck it. They had their 15 minutes. Another band that had their 15 minutes, maybe even 30 minutes, was the Presidents of the United States of America.
Yeah.
This is the track Lump, but it's a live version. I think most people probably immediately fucking recognise that. She's in my head. Very well-known band. Quite a few decent singles. Peaches, Kitty, couple of things off the later one did okay. This was taken from a show they did. I think it was something like an HMV or a Virgin or something like that. They actually split before this came out. So this was out in 98 and they'd split in 97. For a band with 5 strings in total. So 2 bass strings and 3 guitar strings. Mm. For their whole career, this really underlines what a fucking great band of musicians they were. Like they did a totally minimal kit as well. And it was like floor tom, snare, hat. Like, I mean, really just totally stripped back. But they were fucking like really tight, and the tones are great. Like the fucking tones that the Presidents of USA got out of their instruments are remarkable. She's in my head. She's not. I do believe that she's dead. That girl's dead. I think the novelty of their tunes has kind of worn off for me over the years, you know. They feel more like ditties than songs. And I think that's kind of odd because I would have said that, say, a band like Pixies, right? So Pixies do a lot of stuff that's kind of novelty as well, you know, like Gigantic and stuff like that, you know. Yeah, it seems to just have like a little bit more longevity than the Presidents of USA stuff. I don't know if it's because the Presidents of USA stuff's a bit more comedic. Maybe the sort of longevity suffers.
It's a bit, some of it feels a bit goofy. I've never listened to these guys until this, but like parts of it when it sounds a bit more like Weezer is more memorable, but like the kind of wee guitar bits that are a bit goofy.
You must have heard Peaches. I mean, Peaches was such
I just don't know it was them, but I.
Yeah, couldn't. I mean, so like their songs always had a sort of light-hearted kind of air in them. The first album had, like I said, those 3 really big singles, but it was a pretty solid record overall. And then they brought out a second one that felt like maybe it had sort of been rushed out to capitalise on how well they were doing, and it definitely didn't have as many like catchy tunes in it. It had a couple of okay moments, but nothing that was going to cement it. Then they broke up really quickly after. I think Chris Ballew, the main guy, he does like kids TV themes now.
I mean, that totally makes sense.
Yeah, like guitar based. He's sort of become like a bit of a, what's his name, Mark Mothersbaugh. He's gone into like kids TV stuff. Little bear wink, you can join him in his parade. Here comes Stumpy the Bear. Here comes Stumpy the Bear. Yeah, I mean, Presidents of USA, it's hard to hate them because they're great at what they do and it's so amiable and upbeat, but it just doesn't really seem to have a lasting power. Yeah. I don't want to listen to it the same way I want to listen to Pixies.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons I don't have staying power is because it's very much that, you know, Gen X like humour, that very much of that era, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And I think like a lot of the comedy films from that time, they just don't really work either. This continues.
So we're not watching American Pie after this?
What do you call it?
He fucks a pie, Grant. He puts his dick in a pie. How can you guys not get that?
This continues the tradition of a random really big live song on a compilation.
Yeah. But I think it's because for whatever reason they couldn't haggle them down to giving them
probably
the album.
Can't expensive. Probably can't afford it. Sorry, it's just really expensive. You know.
That's it. Then again, it might work the other way because Presidents of USA brought out a live album, so it may be that the label were like, "Here, how about we give you a live record by Presidents of USA, and then people will want to go and buy the live album." So it might not actually be that Kerrang were like saying, "Oh, please, can we have this? Oh, we can't afford that, but we'll take that." It could be the complete opposite dynamic. It could be the label are like, "We've got this live record to sell. The band's broken up. Can we give you a really good live track to try and convince people that their live album's worth buying as well?" So that's what I mean. It's so hard to kind of to just guess what the dynamic was.
Well, if they did release a live record, I really hope it's not got this mix on it because the mix is pretty bad on this.
I don't know if I agree. I mean, I think it's.
I thought for being like, it is a music store or something, isn't it? Because the bit when it's like the folk down the front all bought CDs or something. So there must have been some sort of promotion thing on. Yeah.
Hello, everybody. So they tell me that everybody down on the floor bought our CD to get down on the floor. Thank you very much for buying the CD. Give yourselves a big round of applause. Shame on you people up there.
All right.
And he's like, I actually think it sounds like what you were saying about the band being really tight. I put a note on that because it's, for being a live recording, it's fucking really?
I mean, the guitarist has three strings in his guitar. I mean,
that's good.
It's fucking, it's a big sound for that as well.
I think that for me, the drums and the vocal are too high and the guitars and bass, or if you want to call them those, they call it a bass R and something else. Like they've got names specifically for those instruments.
I did not know that.
Yeah,
I thought the same about the drums, by the way. But interestingly, there was something about listening to all of this because it's all like late 90s music. I was watching, I can't remember what drum shop it was. They were doing a discussion about this new thing they had in, but they were like, see, in the 90s, it's a bit of a like nerdy drum thing, but in the 90s, this drum shop only sold 16-inch crash cymbals, right? Whereas now, no one buys anything less than 18, and it's getting bigger. At one point, it was getting stupidly big, right?
Mm. If you listen, ride at some point.
Well, but even crashes were going to like 21, 22. They used to be rides, right? Mm. But seeing the 90s, all your crashes and like Talking Heads and stuff, it's all like 14 to 16 crash cymbals. So see the live recording of this, I was like, it's all quite high-endy because the cymbals are so small. Yeah. But see, a lot of the drums in this, they're all like that. And it's just interesting once you hear it and you start listening through a lot of 90s records, like REM's really big for it. All their cymbals are really small.
Yeah.
Whereas like that's like metal bands now, that's like a splash.
Yeah.
But that's like a trend that like came out of this. But that was something I noticed in the live recording. I'm like, that's really tinny. But that's actually just the size of the cymbals, and that's like most 90s bands had this. But so, after I did that, I listened back through it, and it's a trend throughout all these things.
Best crash sound in this record is Jenny Torturers. We'll get to that.
That's debatable.
I want to clarify, but I may clarify for the audience as well. So if the cymbal's smaller, it's got a shorter decay, is that right?
Yeah, largely I'd say so, yeah.
Yeah, but it's got a higher pitch. Ride cymbals and crash cymbals, the ride cymbal's generally quite thick as well, because you can bell it and it's just got a kind of...
You get more articulation the heavier cymbal gets, which is why metal cymbals are all like metal... All cymbals are metal. I mean, like, metal genre cymbals are all heavy as fuck, so you get the definition.
You can always tell when a band who's not a metal band is using metal cymbals because it sounds dark. The cymbals sound dark. You know, they sound like they're out of place, which you need to really listen for. The reason I say that is because our drummer in our band used to be in a metal band and he had metal cymbals. You can hear our first demo, you can hear there's metal cymbals on it, and it's like it doesn't really work with the genre of music.
And they're like the weird overtones and stuff, because it's supposed to be really like projecting the cut-throughs. But it was just something I noticed in the live track. And then you kind of notice that like Psycho are really like that as well. All the cymbals are really tiny and splashy. Mm-hmm. There's like no resonance on them and stuff. But then it could be how it's recorded. It's like when did digital recording become quite common? Would that have been like kind of late 90s? Yeah?
Probably about this period, I'd imagine.
I mean, it was like Beach Boys did that Kokomo thing digitally. They were like the first to put an album out like that, weren't they? But yeah, so I mean, it was getting reasonably sophisticated at this point, but it'll also just depend on budget. It'll depend on all kinds of things. But anyway, let's not get too hung up in that. But thank you for that technical input.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That thing that like maybe drummers would only pick up on, but obviously because I've not listened to any of these bands before,
that's why it's so good to have your
I clocked into it and I was like, oh yeah, well it'll be like smaller cymbals and probably smaller drums and like some stuff they hadn't invented yet, which are like quite commonplace now.
Yeah.
And once you hear that once, just going like actually from here to the end of this compilation, it's quite noticeable.
But that's actually, I don't mean to sound patronizing, but that's part of why I'm so impressed with the President's USA guitar and bass tones, because I mean, it's like mid to late 90s and they sound fucking thick, and there are people investing in some crazy expensive pedals now to try and get the same sort of like depth of tone with like, you know, that's pretty remarkable.
I just didn't like the way they were mixed in this particular recording, and I didn't really feel them, like, you know what I mean? Like I didn't feel as though they had a lot of low end either, but hey.
Okay, Poolcass, Rubber Room, the 10th track.
The other earache band on this record.
Poolcass. Where did I know this name? Poolcass. Oh, that's right. They supported fucking everything. Just
really?
We were talking about perennial fucking support bands. Poolcass just on loads and loads of tours. Never seemed to fucking get any real sort of momentum themselves. Grant, I can get a little bit meta here, but do you think Pupil Slicer is one of these bands, right? Because that sort of mid-table, since-forgotten Kerrang compilation fodder sort of a band getting a big push that ends up fizzling out, maybe like, this will probably mean nothing to you, but like Human Waste Project or something like that, like a band that they're like, this is gonna be it. Nah, it fucking didn't do anything. Like, do you think that's what they are? Because Grant and I went to see Pupil Slicer. I know David's a big fan. I was very on the fence about Pupil Slicer. I thought they were really fucking poor. Yet they're a band that's enjoying like a real fucking push, a real wave of like enthusiasm in them, as that show was kind of testimony too.
I was surprised that they were doing a headline tour and playing that album in full that's only been out for 2 years.
Yeah,
I thought that was
in itself suggests that there's a real something.
And again, I'd only checked them out because we were talking about them in that podcast episode. And I think their record sounds okay. I think it's a bit too polished for me, but that's why I went to see them live, because I was like, maybe it's going to be a bit more like grindy or something.
So in their defence, Poolcass apparently were a brilliant live band, regardless of whether or not you like their music. Like, they were very accomplished live musicians. They'd done a lot of touring, they'd done a lot of support stuff. They just knew how to get a really good sound.
Yeah.
I think if Kerrang CDs were about this these days, Pupil Slicer would be the kind of band you'd see at, like, you know, track number 3 or 4 on like Metal Hammer, track number 6 in Kerrang, that kind of thing. Not yet the sort of big hitter, but definitely the inclusion that turns
next in line to the throne sort of thing.
Now, I don't think Poolcass ever had that level of cool. They were a bit too stodgy, but there was definitely a sort of sense that maybe they could do something.
It does have some of the elements of a band which you think could go further. Like, to be perfectly honest, I think out of all the new metal songs on this record, this one's got the delivery that I like the most.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, because it sounds like a punk delivery, do you know what I mean? Like, it's a lot of the screaming you get in new metal songs sounds like fucking Korn, or, you know, it doesn't sound anything like that, which is what I liked about it.
the track is a blatant fucking Helmet riff.
Yeah,
clearly,
pure boneheaded riff.
So yeah, it was taken from an album called Greed, and I think the album overall was a good bit chunkier. On average, the vocals in the record are a bit heavier and lower in register. There's a lot of, like, musically, there's lots of bits of Tool. There's bits of Korn in it. There's a lot of comparisons to Deftone, but I would probably suggest the first Deftone record, you know, Adrenaline, in terms of the riffage and that really scooped guitar tone as well. Maybe a few moments of the vocal style, but not so much the kind of higher range singing. But for me, I just think this track is pure grunge metal landfill. I think it's totally forgettable. The story around Pilkiss, though, is a wee bit more interesting. So the chat is that they were one of the bands to really bear the brunt of Eric's sort of shadier practices.
Oh, okay.
Eric has a sort of Q&A thing on it, which is like almost like a confessional. And you can ask Eric anything you want. And somebody's asked what the fuck went on with Pilkiss. And the Eric response sort of descends into basically Eric protesting that they had a quite justified beef with the band. So after signing them in 1998, Eric's response goes, "The band wasted no time in recruiting a manager who proceeded to shop them to major labels, even though the band were contracted to us for three more albums. They broke off all contact with Eric, so we were forced to spend 2 years wrangling via lawyers, defending our quite legitimate legal and moral position. At some point in the protracted process, the band split up." And I know that the band actually changed their name to, it's like I:AM:I, just some weird fucking thing to try and evade all that contractual stuff. I mean, even if what Eric have said is true, it does seem coincidental at best that so many bands seem to have issues with Eric's business practices. As regards Pilkiss, apparently the band Earthtone 9 have cited them as being a really big inspiration for them.
I can see that.
Yeah, which exactly. It makes sense because they're also like stodgy, new metallic grunge mulch. But yeah, I don't have much time for this tune.
Yeah, like I said, I didn't hate it as much as I thought I was going to hate it, but because I like the vocal delivery, but it is landfill is the best word to describe it, I think.
Very forgettable. Thought it was a bit more like kind of melodic Pantera, but like none of the interesting shit that Pantera would do.
Like Sea Kyles and
White Wine.
White Wine.
We can agree it's interesting.
There's a bit at 2 minute mark that is like the most wee guy like metal thing that I've seen.
Wee guy metal was brilliant, innit?
I can imagine chugging J20s at a catty under this. Same thing with the cymbals that I was talking about. Like, I thought it just sounded like really thin, but that could be the recording. I don't fucking know. Yeah. But yeah, very forgettable.
Yeah, I don't think when this album was recorded, they were on a massive budget.
If you're on Eric, you're not going to be a big budget, you know.
So the compilation takes another fucking neck-breaking turn here by going from Pilkiss into Soulless Island.
Fucking hell.
The runaway train, man.
The runaway train, man. So the track is, and this is Creatures of Habit.
It's an eighth fucking record, by the way. Can we just highlight that?
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Soul Asylum started in 1981.
Yeah.
Right. So Soul Asylum, they're a special sort of mediocre, right? Even their current drummer, his name is Michael Bland. And we on the podcast in the past, we've tried to put our finger on a certain American sound. We did it when we were doing the REM episode. So it's like something that's kind of alternative yet not. So we've talked about bands like the Wallflowers, Counting Crows, the Goo Goo Dolls, Hootie and the Blowfish, Deep Blue Something, even these bands that sort of pretended like they were kind of, oh, we've got guitars and we wear jeans, but they're still kind of like a wee bit commercial and a bit lame. And I think, you know, I wouldn't say Soul Asylum or Deep Blue Something, but they're definitely a crucial part of that tapestry of that MOR American alternative scene. I do also think, though, that There's a couple of listeners, a couple of people in the AAA group that would probably go to bat for them, especially the kind of people that listen to, I don't know if you know about the band Brad, it was a spin-off of Pearl Jam, the kind of people that buy that kind of thing. When I listen to this tune, there's a remnant of a band that I've name-checked a few times called the Jayhawks, albeit they've stripped away all the kind of country stuff from that. Yeah, they did Runaway Train. That's where everybody knows them from. That made them famous. But the singer, Dave Pirner, dating Winona Ryder for 3 years, didn't do them any harm either.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they'd apparently hooked up after Soul Asylum's MTV Unplugged show in 1993. I mean, I kind of... In regards to the people that would go to bat for them, I find the idea of like a Soul Asylum album track or a deep cut like an especially beige proposition, you know.
And this is it.
And I mean, their better known stuff is, you know, it's if we use a nice word, inoffensive enough. I don't need to go rummaging about, but I do wonder if there's like some hidden gems or moments of sort of rougher genius. I mean, given that they started in 81, maybe somewhere in their like 80s back catalogue there's something there, but I'll be fucked if I'm going to go you know, risk searching for it without good reason. I mean, this was the opening track of what was at the time their final album. They kind of broke up effectively until 2006 after this, presumably when their audience had sort of more disposable income and the kids were away to college. Because if you think about it, a Soul Asylum were like that kind of early 90s band, and they come back 16 years later, and those kids that grew up in them were ready to go to the legacy tour shows, you know.
They're not at home anymore, so their parents can go with them because they've got the money as well.
So the track barely happens to me. It's an odd inclusion for Kerrang. I mean, it sticks out even for a kind of K compilation, you know. It's just, I know they did some eclectic stuff, but this is much more of a like Rolling Stone, Uncut, Mojo, that kind of thing. I mean, how many Kerrang kids effectively were swung to Soul Asylum by this? I'm not really sure I follow the thinking.
Is it just to like balance it out so it wasn't all...
I don't think
that doesn't make sense because Kerrang is a rock magazine. So,
and also it's fucking Soul Asylum. It's a scalp. I mean, what I wondered was maybe this is the band or their management making a, you know, maybe a slightly desperate pitch for a new audience amidst maybe faltering fortunes.
Yeah.
Well, the album got lukewarm reviews at the time.
Yeah.
But in terms of like the odd inclusion, I would agree that it is odd on the record, but they had Catherine Wheel on the last one.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I like Catherine.
Yeah, but it's the same kind of ballpark, though. Do you know what I mean? Like, in, I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm just it's like similar sonically.
I agree. I would say this is. I mean, I would. This is going to sound mental to some people, but I would say Catherine Wheel had a good bit more cutting edge than Soul Asylum.
Yeah, but I would agree with that. I think this is clearly a guys who are at the end of their career still trying to find a direction that somewhat fits with what's happening in the rock charts. The thing that I think you tried to put your finger on but couldn't, which the band, some of these bands that you were talking about have in common, is Tom Petty. That's the influence.
That's
a really good shout.
I really don't like Tom Petty.
Tom Petty, didn't he like Tom Petty?
Yeah. I think Tom Petty, for a lot of people, Tom Petty is like one of the peak American songwriters, right? I don't really get him. Like, some people put him in the same category.
Fucking Everclear covered American Girl. There you go.
American Girl is a good example of the kind of, you know, inoffensive, technically well-written stuff, you know what I mean? Like, I know people that put him in the same category as Bruce Springsteen. I'm like, what the fuck are you smoking? That's insane.
And Neil Young,
But it is that, it's that Americanness, not Americana, but Americanness of Tom Petty, which is still blue-collar, but vastly different from the other Americanness of like a Bruce Springsteen.
You're right, Runaway Train could have been a Tom Petty song.
100%, man, you know? Yeah. And so all the bands that were like hooting the blowflesh and all, blowfish and all that kind of stuff, it's that Tom Pettiness is what gives them that feel.
And inoffensiveness, you know, that gets them into pickup trucks. Yeah, maybe so. I mean, maybe the magazine just got the opportunity to include a name as big as Soul Asylum and they were like, fuck it, it's a sort of big hitter name.
Big name that's 11th track though.
Yeah,
but I guess because it's not really the right genre. I don't know if they were just like fucking stuck it in there.
Bury it, but people will turn heads anyway because we've got them, you know.
I've not really listened to a lot of Soul Asylum, surprisingly, but it seemed a bit more compared to what we've just had as well. It seemed kind of competent. Like, I don't think
it's their eighth album.
And, I don't think it's good, but I feel like it, out of all the tracks that have been, well, not all of them, but like it's definitely doing a thing.
Yeah,
but it also sounds a bit strange in the way of like the guitar wants to be Slash. and the rest of the band don't want him to be Slash. Would be a great.
Is that not the same as Guns N' Roses though?
I think it's a little bit.
That's a whole other episode.
It's all around, I think.
would be great in a montage section of a rom com. I think this song.
Yeah,
that's why. As soon as I heard it,
Soul Asylum are in some serious money for sync over the years, man.
Aye. Maybe that's their competency, is like they can write to that vibe.
I mean,
but it doesn't make any sense being in this compilation.
Dayton Winona Ryder in amongst all those kind of like young Liv Tyler, Gen X films, like Soul Asylum were that, the kind of TV dramas, all the coming of age kind of shows. I'm sure they were probably in Party of Five and fucking My So-Called Life and all that kind of stuff. It's that kind of thing. Yeah, they'd have made a mint in that.
I think musically they're probably good for that kind of thing, but these guys are on their 8th record, right? And this is not their audience, age-wise, absolutely. Like, nobody at this age is listening to fucking Soul Asylum, right? So I totally buy the last desperate pitch from a record label to try and get them some credibility before they inevitably did fuck off into the ocean.
They got back together and made more albums since.
I thought the intro of this sounds a bit like Death Cab, which Death Cab did become a band that was featured in, like, Kerrang and stuff. And
Death Cab are a better, but sort of good analogy for that kind of modern equivalent of Soul Asylum, like, kind of like... tuneful, a bit wishy-washy, kind of indie, kind of alternative.
You can Tom put Petty, them on movies.
Been around for a bit fucking 20-odd years now as well.
Yeah. Okay, track 12. Cecil, or Cecil, I'm not sure what they used, but The Most Tiring Day.
Oh my god,
most tiring song.
So I mentioned Craig. I have the strangest feeling that Craig's quite a big fan of Cecil.
Oh my fucking god, Craig.
if that's wrong,
is Craig alright?
He'll be freaking out. But I just see it's stuck in my head. I think he liked this band. So mate. I mean, the first impressions for anyone here are going to be the whiny voice, aren't they?
Right. So it sounds like the guy from Savage Garden.
A wee bit, yeah.
Which is an immediate red flag to
mixed
me.
With the guy from JJ72.
I'm wrong. I'm a big Savage Garden guy.
I know a lot of people that are big Savage Garden fans. So.
I don't know any of the words, but if you were to put any Savage Garden song on, I could sing along.
I wanna stand with That's you.
Cascada did that one better, but they believe it or not, they have better songs than that.
Hopefully,
we'll come back for another episode. I love a Savage Garden.
Hope Jason's listening, because he asked me. He said, "Should we do a Savage Garden cover?" And I was like, "Absolutely fucking not."
Shit.
Mate. We are not doing this.
You don't have the cultural capital to get away with that. Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't mind the bass in this, actually. I was trying to look for positives, and it's got that kind of rhythmic pulsing, pushing bass, which is all right. And there's an inexplicable series of key changes in this tune that are just totally
all over the place, man.
Me.
Yeah.
What the fuck? I mean, the chorus is a total non-event as a result, because if you're being generous, the verse builds a sort of melodic minor key tension, and then it just sort of totally aborts that and goes completely off in a different direction. I mean, the tune's pretty rotten overall, and even the tone that's used for those little guitar solo bits is really poor as well. I'm not sure what they're thinking. I remember their debut album, right, called Bombard Diddler, and the singles on it caused a bit of fuss. I mean, they turned a lot of heads. This is from their second record, and I think it's long since sunk into that mire of unremarkable Brit rock post grunge stuff. They really played up their grunge connections though, because Bomb Our Diddler was recorded by Barrett Martin, who's the first Foo Fighters album guy.
Oh, okay.
And the third record that they were about to do, it never actually happened, but it was going to be done at Stone Gossard's studio.
Oh.
But the label dropped them basically and the project got scrapped. But I mean, this is another band that toured with everybody. So they toured at the time with like Skunk Anansie, the Wild Hearts, Feeder, Levelers, Paw, who were a kind of big post-grunge band, Manson, taking them into the indie terrain. They later changed their name to Voi in 2000, I think for a kind of reset, and then they changed it again in 2005 to Fridge Mountain Fires. Fucking knows why. At which point you really are like, lads, I think this might be done.
Yeah, I'll let it go.
But honestly, it's such a banal song. Like, yeah. Really, this one did not work for me at all.
So, strap in, boys. This song is the definition of insipid for me. It's just a beige paste of a song. It's like, you know, in the Matrix when they go into the real world and they get the gloop out of the big fucking the big machine. It's that. It may contain all the elements that food has, like nutrients and vitamins and that, but it's just not food. And this song is just not a song. It contains all of the parts that make music and music itself, but it does not fucking congeal into an actual song. It's got no hook, it's got no personality, it's got no anything. According to Wikipedia, they get signed to EMI after playing their first gig, which was a battle of a band arranged by Liverpool Echo newspaper.
Oh yeah.
So somebody was rich in the band, basically saying,
fucking hell.
I fucking hated this song so much.
Yeah, it's not good. I just really, when I hear it, I can almost hear a chorus that should have happened, and yet it just doesn't. And I just don't know what the fuck they were thinking, but hey. Maybe that's why this track's on here, though. They were like, nah, just stick that one on. It's not that important to us. I don't really know.
I had the same thing that I actually started trying to chart this song out, because I was like, are they playing the same parts?
Yeah.
I feel like there's a lot of like verse one, verse two, verse three, chorus, bridge,
asterisk.
The last 30 seconds, I actually was raging the first time I heard it and I had to listen to it again.
Yeah, same.
Because
they
do some sort of like,
it's like a weird key change.
Is it like, it's almost like a coda on like actual like written music. Mm-hmm, they do like some sort of thing. They go back to a phrase that they did once that wasn't very good. And they do this weird like off-kilter bit and like hit kind of diminished chords, and I'm like, that fucking sucks.
And they probably thought it was great because they brought it all back.
I think what you're saying about like, it's got a lot of components, like they have a lot of like maybe clever, musically clever things, but the way it's orchestrated and like structured, it's actually tough to listen to. Yeah. There's way too much flanger. Just everything. It seems like they just got to a bit, they'd be like, fucking turn it up, flanger for four bars, then they go back to another bit. But
maybe the engineer was like, I need to do something.
So there's just a lot of stuff wrong with it, and it's also far too long.
It's far too long.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know if that's just because it sucks. That is like listening to it just feels punishing. But
how are you feeling about the back end of this CD? Because it's
about to kick up again. Yeah.
An embarrassment of riches.
The 13th track, Pissing Razors, with the song World of Deceit. So this is like Fear Factory, Machine Head kind of area, dead techie, scooped groove metal. There's lots of Pantera in it.
Well, they were on a Pantera compilation and like later
the covers thing, so. Yeah. I mean, to be fair though, they're another groove metal band from the American South, started by two brothers, so there's a fair few parallels.
Just like Oasis.
I think Piss and Razors, to be fair to them, went for some slightly more eclectic timings and changes. On three with this month's issue, the podcast, they actually take great exception to the number of time changes in this song. I mean, I have to be honest, I mean, it gets a real pasting for them, but I don't hate it. I mean, I never did and probably never would sit with this kind of metal. To be honest, it just really bores me, but I think it has to be probably the most knuckle-draggy Y-chromosome subgenre of metal itself. But does this one sound much worse than most in that? I'm not really sure that it does. I don't really hear it as being a massive drop off. I mean, some of the drum stuff in it, I think those little shifts in accent are actually really quite interesting. A lot more so, actually, than some of the bands I just mentioned. There's, I think it's about 2 minutes, there's a sudden kind of lunge forward into a driving section that I think is actually pretty decent. I mean, I could watch that live and imagine my neck starting to bob. I'm not sure why there's sampled laughter at 3 minutes 15. But I mean, I definitely don't think the arrangement is the worst.
It does have a lot of the sort of, when Sepultura did groovier stuff, like kind of feel to it. I enjoy the shuffle in the main riff at the start. I think it's a pretty cool part. The drum sound is pretty nice, I think, as well. But the song kind of lacks personality for me compared to a band like Fear Factory or Pantera or,
I agree. But this is the first record.
That Machine Head, you know?
That scans.
Well, I tell you what, maybe doesn't scan, but I think deserves a bit of credit. This album was completely self-released by the band. So it was called, and wait for it, because it's a fucking belter, Psycho Punko Metal Groove, which sounds like a bootleg in China that's been badly translated. But that's what the album was called, and fuck me, the artwork as well is absolutely chronic. The official band camp of Piss and Razors says, quote, and this is a quote, brackets, sick, their purpose was to incite a musical tone, loud and aggressive in ferocity, heavy in punk and metal, and include a groove. So the record had 20 tracks in it. 20 tracks.
You don't need that many songs.
Of this. No thanks.
No.
Which is surely another sign as well. It was self-released and nobody from a label intervened and was like, hey boys, let's just keep some back. You know, nobody said that to them.
I can't imagine writing 20 songs of this for your debut album. Like, but, that's insane.
Think about it though. This record, I mean, it got them a fair bit of attention. It got them on some really good tours. It got them on a fucking Kerrang compilation on the other side of the Atlantic. I mean, did they buy their way on? That seems unlikely. Is it here on merit? I think it's actually probably here because of some benevolent writer at the magazine was like, well done to them. But this is fucking self-released. I mean, I honestly think that's pretty amazing when you consider that, like, Fear Factory, Machine Head, Pantera, who was putting them out at the
time? Yeah, like, the internet as well.
Yeah.
Of, like,
I mean, fucking good for them, you know?
Actually, not sonically, but, like, I don't know if you guys have ever listened to Meet Me in St. Louis.
Have a long time.
Kind of post-hardcore mathy band, but like not like math rock. But all their songs are like, they do like part A, part B, A, C. Like the song never repeats.
Right,
it's not like a normal structure song. It made me think of that in the way of like, I think they must have spent a long time working in this. But yeah, I was trying to work out some of the, I think the drummer's writing a lot of that, because there's definitely a bit.
It feels drum-led at points, doesn't it?
Well, apart from the vocal bit, which I think is kind of boring, but I would need vocals. It can't just be like riffs all the time.
That whole subgenre has that same boring vocal for me though.
Drum intro is sick. About a minute and five, there's like an inverted padded diddle rudiment. That's the bit where it's like, it really cuts it and stabs. Do a lot of like three against four, and then it kicks back into the straight up rhythm you were talking about. Yeah. And then there's a lot of like kind of 5/8 playing over like bars and stuff like that. Yeah. Real good syncopation. Like they must have spent a long time like working on it and then practicing it, because it actually sounds like it was recorded live as well. But no, like, a lot of it is genuinely interesting. Laugh track is a massive red flag, right in the bin. Fucking hate.
No idea
why they put that in. The big outro bit and the shuffle rhythm, and then they start, like, moving the pulse around and moving the backbeat. It's been done to death now, but maybe in 97, 98. Like, that's actually quite interesting.
I mean, they were probably recording it in 96 or 97, yeah.
Yeah, I actually listened to that a couple of times and was like, this is, like, fun to listen to and try, like, map out yeah. like the kind of structure of it, but vocals aren't very interesting. But if it's their first album, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed Piss and Razors.
I'm not really sure what they did after it, but honestly, I think they did a pretty fucking good job for what it is.
Out of all the stuff on this compilation, I think I'm going to give that album a go. over Jenny Cantrell.
Tracks it.
That's going to be like, what? That song's like 5 minutes long as
Imagine
well.
Imagine how many beats that poor guy's got to remember. Okay.
You can't get 20 tracks that are 5 minutes long on a CD.
I mean, it will be pushing the maximum time. Yeah. Maybe it's like you could get them up to 80 minutes if you got the right CD. But anyway, track 14, Jenna Torturers, and the tune Razor Cuts. So
what?
So this is a glam industrial thing. The band called themselves, quote, the world's sexiest rock band. And I don't know if that was just by dint of the front woman, because some of the other guys, man, are interesting. You ever seen the first X-Men film?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Hey, do you remember the bit where the senator gets kind of that water mutation yeah. power?
Oh, and he squeezes through the bars.
And he's squeezing through the prison bars, right? Pause it there, get a Sharpie and draw an emo fringe on it. fair play for fucking self-confidence. They actually shortened their name to Jenny Torturers from the festering Jenny Torturers, which is actually an improvement. So I get the raunch thing, because they were coming out of Florida at the same time as Marilyn Manson. Their live shows, I do remember them now a bit, because they had all these like live kinky theatrics in them. So they had, it was somewhere between like BDSM and the Jim Rose Circus, you know. You had like backing dancers with like metal plates on their crotches and angle grinders, you know, shooting sparks out into the crowd and stuff. It was quite OTT performative thing. Jen, G-E-N, as in, I think that's part of where they came up with the name, who was the bassist, sort of became the front woman in the face of the band. She was married to the guy Dave Vincent, that band Morbid Angel, and he joined this band on bass, at which point she just, I think, went to singing duties. I actually think this record sounds a fair bit like a budget version of White Zombie.
I've said Rob Zombie, but
well,
yeah,
not so much Rob Zombie. I think more White Zombie. I mean, it got a proper slagging on that other podcast. I think they actually called it the worst on the disc, and I don't really hear it as being the worst on here. I think it makes up with the sense of fun where it maybe lacks in sort of slickness and actual credibility. There's a great little bit, by the way, at 1:22, just this little thing where they go back into a verse using these kind of harmonics and feedback, and it's actually a fucking really, really clever little idea. Albeit it's just a momentary thing. The cymbals I was talking about, they're fucking hilarious, the cymbal sounds in this. I mean, it sounds like they actually used the pre-programmed sounds from like an electric kit out of Argos. It's that bad. You know, the rubber...
The DJ sitting on the piano.
Oh, it is fucking horrendous.
Well, I couldn't tell if it's electric drums at the beginning and then there's like a really distorted drum kit comes in towards the end.
Maybe it's
but I don't know if overlaid. I don't know if the one's like an acoustic one they've like affected or if it was just all digital or not.
Yeah, I don't really know what the live setup was. I mean, they could have also had somebody that did sort of electronic percussion. I don't know, but it's fucking bad tone. I mean, the track itself is pretty throwaway, but it doesn't really offend me. You know, it does its thing, doesn't do it very well, but they don't really seem to take it too seriously. And actually, at the end of it, I wasn't like, I don't fucking hate that one. It's just there. It's certainly...
I find it annoying more than anything. I feel nothing about it except some of the synth stuff, like the kind of weird noisy bits, was almost leading somewhere interesting. And then it was just this like horrible vocal section, and like the song structure was weird. Yeah, it's like not I don't think it's the worst one on the compilation, but I definitely didn't enjoy it.
But it's down there.
It's got good company.
It reminds me of early, well, some bits of like Antichrist Superstar era Marilyn Manson sonically, you know, which is mostly engineered by Trent Reznor anyway. So some of that, it doesn't have the same drama as those kind of two of Nine Inch Nails and Marilyn Manson. They are very dramatic acts.
I mean, it sounds more, what's the word? It sounds more rudimentary. So maybe it's closer to sort of like Pretty Hate Machine.
It is very much in its line of industrial metal from this period in time, you know. You can see the word clearly listening to bands like, I thought Rob Zombie, but maybe you said White Zombie was right. Marilyn Manson, Nine Inch Nails, Ministry even in places, you know. So I found it to be quite abrasive sonically, not in a nice way. The electronic kit thing would totally make sense if it did it, because that was a thing that industrial bands did. It's not the worst song on the record. I kind of don't feel anything about it either. But it did remind me of like Antichrist Superstar in places, just with the guitar tones and some of the synth sounds and all that. So
I mean, I'd imagine when you see the spectacle of the live shows and video and stuff like that, it must have been a pretty good laugh.
I was on the Instagram earlier on, and like they do have a live drummer, and I think the bass player from the Murder Dogs played for them for a bit as well, which is totally on brand according to Wikipedia. But apparently,
that's right, they've had a lot of people go through the ranks.
Yeah, I was going to say, in Wikipedia the list of members is a giant, absolutely huge.
That's right.
Apparently they're very, very highly thought of in the fetish community. I didn't know that.
Makes sense.
You can see it for the live shows, as we see on Instagram, some of the shit is pretty out there. So you do get a cab, you get a very much of a cabaret vibe when
that's
you see,
high.
That, see their images
goth
on
cabaret
Instagram.
Thing, So am I the only one that's able to do a report on Cold and Give? Enhanced CD did not enhance my experience. So here's the thing, right? So I've mentioned that I was an absolute groupie for the first Cold record in a past episode. This is like 1998, 99 kind of period. I mean, I really liked, they had an ultra dirgy guitar sound. I mean, it sounded really down-tuned, but then it also sounded really like the way it was EQ'd and things. It was like a grunge version of Korn. Crunch, Gurn. I mean, that sounds like one of these lyrics, right? Because that fucking accent. But it'd be clearly they were elevated as well due to the connections to the likes of Fred Durst. So Jonathan Davis and Fred Durst are in the video. It's kind of an X-Files spin-off thing, which is kind of peak 90s as well. Narrative-wise, the video, I mean, there's a girl walking around the hospital. Then Jonathan Davis and Fred Durst discover some huge tentacled monster in an unlit room. And then Scooter Ward, the singer, has this sort of icy standoff with this girl, which is just dead awkward. And then there's lots of cold imagery, so you've got like visible breath in it, and there's fridges and there's frost everywhere, but it's a fucking tonal mess. The video, it's like, wait a minute, is this a monster thing, or is this a relationship thing, or is this a hospital cadaver thing? It doesn't fucking know what the fuck it's doing. Scooter Ward's voice, I think, is the eggiest of
all voices.
and I really want to look at some of the lyrics, okay, because they need a fucking translator, right? There's a line in it, "You silly freak, you super fuck." You're silly. Which I think is an amazing line. There is a totally imperceptible line that I had to look up, where the words are, "I'll take the world, blow it away." I'll cut that in and you tell me if that's what he's saying. "I'll take the world, blow it away." I mean, it's just that, like a giant half-chewed mouthful of eggy, bready, gummy nonsense.
It's wet,
it's starchy, it's kind of half chewed. It's followed by this line, "Send all your hopes to outer space." And what does that mean? Is that good? I mean, I think it's meant to be bad, but "send all your hopes to outer space." I'm not sure what he's getting at there. And how about this for some fucking mixed metaphors, okay? The following bit goes, "Everyone around you laid with dogs, like a bitter pill that lost its taste."
Yeah,
Now that's fucking writing for you folks.
I bet you he thought that was really clever when he thought that. And
everyone around you laid with dogs like a bitter pill that lost its taste. So
there are layers to, I will grant them, there are layers to that, right?
So a bitter pill like lays with dogs. So everyone around you, in the same way as a bitter pill would lay with dogs.
So dogs like bitter pills, and people
and it had lost its taste, remember.
People also like dogs and or bitter pills.
If you see,
have lost their taste, have the dogs lost their taste?
If you see dogs lying about, the chances are there will be tasteless yet still somehow bitter pills lying with them.
Yeah.
And that's what Scooter's trying to warn us about.
Okay.
I'm sure we're all quite moved by that.
Who's the you in this sense?
It kind of feels like somebody was messing about with a really old fashioned AI. I mean, the lyrics in the band are just, they're like that all the way through. And the weird thing is, right, it's only now that I'm sort of picking up on that, because I mean, I listen to this band a lot. And see where I grew up, right? I got into a lot of tussles over the years, right? And I got jumped by.
You?
Aye. Got jumped by a couple of gangs.
And couldn't scooter.
And I'm watching this video, right? And I'm remembering that time in my life. And I'm remembering how much I liked the band. And actually, I wish I could go back and thank those gangs, because I fucking deserve it for being in this band. Every fucking bit of stone that hit me in the beak, that was well deserved, because honestly, for the life of me, I don't know what the fuck I was thinking. Like, the more you dig into this band, the fucking stupider it gets. And the voice alone, I mean, I feel like somebody that left a cult and is like looking back going, what? How did that? Oh,
is it maybe all the bricks that made you like them? Getting hit in the head over and over again?
Actually maybe cured me.
I guess so, actually, yeah. But it's been like either way.
The Homer Simpson thing with the crane up the nose. You know what I mean? It's like,
I put it back in.
Anyway, yeah, so I'm sorry you didn't get to enjoy Cold, but Grant, I would encourage you to go away and listen to it.
Oh, I'm going to. I mean, honestly, I've got a playlist to get through after.
I genuinely think the guitar tones are something to be said for them. You know, song Hooker with a Penis by Tool? That really dirgy, ugly guitar tone. It's kind of in that vein, but then everything else about it is mint.
Garbage.
Actually, we ended on Garbage. We started on Garbage. There you go.
Hey. Nice.
So I asked you, as the tradition, to pick a highlight, a lowlight, and just a wild card. Highlight, lowlight speak for themselves. The wild card can be good, it can be bad, it can be a curio, it can be something that you're like, I might listen to them, and blah, blah, blah. So, Grant, go to you first, your highlight.
Highlight. Well, this was a tough one.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say Janis Stark.
Oh, yeah? Does it mean?
In terms of like being able to re-listen to it and enjoy it,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wouldn't listen to it in my own free time. But out of all the songs, I found it like, actually it has aged well for a song that's 20 odd years old.
That's fair. Mark?
Bad Religion, obviously.
The highlight's Bad Religion?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. It's not a great Bad Religion tune, so not for me, nah.
But I think it's catchy enough, and I like the structure of it because it's atypical.
Yeah.
Well, yours is Everclear, then he went to.
I mean, as I said, Lump's kind of adorable, but I can't be fucked with it now. And Janis Stark, yeah, I agree, it's fine, but never sent my world alight. But yeah, I mean, Everclear. Just a really good tune from a good album, regardless of how painfully unhip it is to actually say that.
Do you know my first note for Everclear is Chris really into this band? Question mark.
So glad we asked you back, Grant. Your lowlight.
Oh, this was tough picking one.
Yeah, but you can mention a couple of other also rans.
The Jenna Torturers was pretty low. But having talked through it, I agree it's not actually, it's not the worst one. It's just a bit confusing. Probably Cecil. is just all over the fucking place.
Yeah.
And it's just like, actually, like the last 30 seconds really pushed me over the edge and is like frustrating to listen to. So that would be them for my wow. life.
Yeah.
Mark.
Cecil, fuck them. Fuck the Caterwaul.
Cecil, wow.
Fuck people. I never want to hear Flanger again.
By the way, I mean, if Craig is a fan, I kind of want to put you guys head to head.
But it would be pointless.
So I think Soul Asylum and Pulchus were both pretty bad in different ways. I think Cecil is mince, and I do not get the thinking behind those key changes, but the worst by a good measure for me is 1 minute silence.
Alexis Crouch presents
for a multitude of reasons beyond the song itself, but yeah, not least for his current pair.
The wild card.
The wild card, Grant. Your wild card.
So I've got two.
That's all right.
The intro to Psycore is so good. And could have been a really good, like, 2 minute long noise rock song.
Yeah.
And then they just fuck it.
Right.
And then fucking what they call Piss and Razors.
Mm. Yeah.
Not good, but is really interesting. Like,
so you're like, I might go and listen to this.
I think I probably will. I think the fact it's their first album, mm-hmm. I find that it's more interesting, but not good enough to be my high point.
Fucking
so.
Self-release as well. Amazing.
Yeah.
Mark, yeah. Low light. Wildcard.
Probably Janis Stark. I thought quite highly of the way it was played and the way it sounded, so I don't know if I'll go back and listen to it immediately, but I think there was obviously something going on with the band, which I think is pretty cool. So there's a lot of dog shit in this, man. A lot of it's quite egregious as well. So picking a wild card was exceptionally difficult. And I did like Piss and Razors as well. You know, I did like the drum sound of it. And I did like the guitar sound as well. Your vocals are boring, but that's like, you get what you get.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get what you get with groove metal.
Get what you pay for.
Yeah.
My wild card... it's got to be Psycore. Again. Which I think was my wild card the last time we did them. And Mark, it's coming down the track. I think I can feel an episode on Psycore's
fucking hell, man.
Album coming.
Actually quite difficult to find out any decent information about them online as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of their stuff out there. Yeah, the record Your Problem. I might take us there. Just for the lols.
Christ.
I'm busy that night, sorry.
Me too.
All right, Grant, thank you for joining us.
Yes.
Thanks for having me.
How was it compared to the last time?
I enjoyed both, but this is different because I'm not having to like
defend.
Not trying to push an album on being like, I love this album, trying to tell folk.
Yeah.
Just slagging off bands that I've no horse in, I've never listened to them at all. But interesting, listen to a lot of 90s music that I've never heard before.
I mean, honestly, see when I realised when this was from, I actually was really pleased that we'd already asked you to do it, because I was like, fuck man, a lot of this will be totally new to you. I mean, I had no idea you weren't familiar with Jerry Cantrell or Alice in Chains and stuff, but even that is like fascinating. So you'd like just a totally fresh set of ears.
Best face wee boy.
Yeah, it's mad that, eh? Well, yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Did you enjoy it?
I mean, no. That's a stupid question. No. We've yet to enjoy any of the compilation ones. I mean, there have been good moments in them, but overall, you're just like, fucking hell, man.
Yeah, they're hard work, and not in a way that...
Oh, the album's not... The episode's less work, but the fucking listening records...
Because it's very rare you come across like an actually horrible song, Cecil being an exception. Most of them so far have just been quite dull.
They're very of the time, aren't they? Like, they're all... There's a lot of like overlap, and like the middle bit of that album, when it's like 1 minute silence, there's like four like new metal songs back to back. But I guess that's just what it was. But yeah, I'm gonna go try find my. I'm down in the air this weekend, so I'm gonna go find my Krang CDs, and I'm just gonna have a wee look.
Just donate them to the kitty.
The bag of death.
Yeah,
I'm sure my mum will want them at the house. I'll come and drop them.
So how she remembers.
Actually,
you.
I'll hold them back until Christmas time.
And thanks again to Free with this month's issue, the podcast. But I think we're going to reach out to those guys, maybe see if we can collaborate on one of these episodes with them. That could be really good fun. But yeah, now that you've heard their bitter Scottish take on this compilation, you could go and listen to theirs, which is genuinely a lot more upbeat and positive. I mean,
we just say it how it is, you know?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Years of being downtrodden and resentful. If you like this podcast, please go and subscribe. We have an absolutely belting array of things coming in for the Record Club at the moment. Like, really, really good. Just in the last few weeks, we've got a whole load of excellent stuff, including a couple of things that we actually did episodes on. So yeah, please get involved with that. You can subscribe via Patreon, Mark.
Yeah, patreon.com/unsungpod. And you can have an episode without adverts on it, which is nice.
Yeah, no adverts. You can also, as part of that, get involved in the AAA group if you use Facebook, and that's kind of where you can suggest episodes, give us direct feedback. We're pretty engaged on there with people that listen to the show.
Tell us how much you love Cecil.
But I mean, Grant, your first footprint in this was by influencing an episode via that, wasn't it? Short Paris.
Oh yeah, aye,
that was courtesy of you that we did that, and that's to date top three episodes for me. So
it is a really good episode. I forgot about that. Yeah. I didn't even find that band. I can't actually remember who showed me it. But yeah, no, that was a really interesting one for like the episode going much deeper into the band. Like,
the whole context of Russia and stuff like that.
Yeah. Because I went and saw them, and I drove to Manchester to see them, and it was out of all the legit bands I've seen, it was.
Oh, I would. I mean, having heard them now, I would definitely drive to Manchester.
Maybe only 120 folk in the room watching them.
But yeah, that was a product of someone getting involved with us on the AAA group. So please go and do that. It's only $4 a month. I mean, you can pay more if you want, but you know, that's how you can start. Thanks very much for listening. We will be back next week with fuck knows what. We'll just improvise, but yep, it'll be good.
It'll be good.
See you on the other side.
Nice one. Cheers for having me. Stoked to be here.
Fucker.